Web Talk Radio is brought to you by Replay Radio at replay-radio.com. It turns your PC into a sophisticated web radio VCR. It's a great way to enjoy listening to the radio. Record your favorite music and radio shows and stations, and then listen anywhere and whenever you want on any device you want. Get the free trial download at replay-radio.com.
Thank you for joining us from around the world. This is Web Talk at webtalkradio.com. You're listening to the Internet's Future, and I'm Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Dana Greenlee. Thanks so much for joining us today. Straight ahead on the program this week, we'll peel back the onion on stopping spam. Why is it that we may be too late to save email? Red Herring Blogger discusses the viability of the social networking sites like Rise.com, LinkedIn.com, and Meetup.com. Is AOL and MSN and Yahoo growing up with its users and slowly becoming digital TV networks?
Surfers flock to SuperBowl.com site in January. The MyDoom virus drives traffic to internet security sites. And a new way to send email messages using RSS feeds, and the MSN folks launch a toolbar in our digital mailbag with a message from a listener who has moved from the U.S. to Turkey and has taken us with him.
Spam is just killing email as a useful way to communicate and share your documents, but the damage is not being done the way you're thinking. We'll speak with tech analyst Frank Catalano about the collateral damage being done by the overwhelming volume of spam and virus emails like we saw this past week. This collateral damage, as Frank says, is the most underappreciated casualty of the spam epidemic, and maybe why it could be too late to save the killer net application called email.
The collateral damage is because of the crossfire between spammers and anti-spammers, and pretty much all of us who use email are caught in this crossfire. There are three things that are contributing to email's decline in reliability, and they are basically crushing volume, undisclosed filtering, and then inconsistent feedback.
Red Herring blogger Mitch Radcliffe is back with us this week to talk about the future and viability of all those social networking sites like Rise.com, LinkedIn, Meetup, Friendster.com, Hipster, and the Tribe. Plus, we will discuss whether AOL, MSN are growing up with its customers and becoming more than just an online ISP.
Some of them are about creating networks online, for instance, business networking, mm-hmm. where I can introduce somebody to somebody else and say, this is a good person, you know, trust them to at least take a call or answer their email. Some of them are oriented around getting people together in real space, like Meetup, or a lot of the Friendster network is around getting people together to go out and party. Everybody's doing these experiments now to see whether or not and where the business exists. And I'm sure there's business in connecting networks of people. There's this funny little thing called the internet that proves that.
Rob, it's time to take a quick look at what's happening this week on the web.
Dana, the SuperBowl.com site has attracted about 5.5 million visitors over the course of the last month here in January. Oh. So they've really had a lot of traffic this past month, and it's up quite a bit from the last couple of years.
Oh, I bet you it'll tail off after this weekend, though.
Yeah, well, and I think it's going to spike this weekend, too.
Well, that's not the only place that got a lot of traffic. Good old Symantec.com, they're the antivirus software company, saw a huge increase, 23% more people coming to their site. Why?
Because of all those viruses flying around. I'm sure most of our listeners, if not all of our listeners, had their box filled up earlier this week with virus messages being sent from all their friends. People were logging on to download the latest antivirus software so they could protect their computers. The site attracted more than 1.5 million unique visitors. There's actually been a bounty put up for the creator of the MyDoom virus, hasn't there?
$250,000 from the company SCO and $250,000 from Microsoft, so that you get $500,000 if you turn in the bad guy.
That's right. So be on the lookout for that hacker and that virus writer.
Rob, there's a lot of politics flying around this week. MoveOn.org is doing its bit to promote the Democratic National Party. They ran a contest a few weeks ago or a while ago that let people send in 30-second ads that were basically putting down Bush's administration. Mm-hmm. And the winner is now posted up at bushin30seconds.org, or you can go to it, moveon.org.
Yeah, and the site traffic has jumped about 44% during the week of January 25th, and has seen about a 74% increase in the site's traffic overall to the site because they want to see the censored ad that's playing off of that website.
Let me explain that. CBS is censoring this ad that was, they had actually bought time on CBS to air during the Super Bowl, and CBS won't air it now, and that got a lot of controversy. But you can go see it on the web, but also MoveOn.org is calling for a little bit of a boycott. So during the halftime when the ads should have run, switch over to CNN and actually see them run. That's at 8:10 p.m. Eastern Time and 8:35 p.m. Eastern Time.
And also, there was an announcement this week by Microsoft that they've launched their own toolbar, just like Google has. And if you wanted to go get that toolbar, you can go to toolbar.msn.com.
Rob, you're a big fan of the RSS feed, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And there's a company up in Canada that's come out with a new application, an online application, that enables you to send an email to them, and it will generate an RSS news feed from it. So it's a way, basically, for companies to comply with the Can-Spam Act that was recently passed. And it's kind of a cool way to send a message to somebody else without having to use the complete process of email. Let's say you have a problem sending an email to somebody because of some spam block or something like that. You can actually stay in communication with somebody using this site. It's at iupload.com, and the service is Mail by RSS. So go check it out.
Rob, I'm digging into our digital mailbag. We got a nice email from Imra Oral. Imra said, I used to listen to your show on CNET Radio back when I was living in San Francisco. I'd come back to Turkey last year to serve my mandatory military service time, something every male Turkish citizen has to do. Oh, I'm really sorry about that, Imra.
I'm sure he's not too sad about it.
Well,
but,
I don't know. I guess you're right. I was so glad to find that I could still listen to you guys on the internet. I'm still enjoying your great show and just wanted to say hi to you from Turkey. Congratulations. Keep it up. Thank you
for the email. Yeah, it's great. And if you have some interesting comments that you want to send us, please send them to either Dana and I. You can send them to Dana@webtalkradio.com, or you can send them to me at Rob@webtalkradio. And those are very special listener emails only. So that's an address that you can get to us directly. So send us your thoughts. We want to hear from you. Support for the Web Talk Radio show every week is provided by Replay Radio at replay-radio.com. And Replay Radio basically enables you to turn your PC into a sophisticated web radio VCR, and you can record all the favorite radio programs that you have actually broadcast, or the online streams that you want to get to for your MP3 player. Or you can listen anywhere on the road, in your car or whatever, by recording your radio shows with this software. So they also have a list of shows of about 400 shows and stations that are pre-programmed into the software, and it also records music too. So go check out replay-radio.com, and they've got a free trial download.
Another sponsor of Web Talk Radio is InfoCreek.com. They're a low-cost website design firm. They do great-looking high-tech sites. We're thrilled with what they're doing with our new site that's about to be launched, and we definitely ask that you go check out InfoCreek.com. Look at their portfolio of ads. You can see a sneak peek of Web Talk Radio's website as well.
We'd also like to thank Compass Communications at ccom.net, and they're a great web server co-location facility up in the Seattle area, the Westin Building, which is sitting on the Nets Gateway to Asia online.
In a moment, Frank Catalano will join us. He's going to talk about the collateral damage that's being done to our trust in email because of the dreaded spam.
This is Web Talk Radio.
Radio lovers, you can now record thousands of radio stations, listen anywhere you want, and even fast forward over the fluff. How? With Replay Radio. It's easy to use and incredibly cool. Replay Radio turns your PC into a VCR for the radio. To listen, just use your PC, MP3 player, iPod, or car CD player. So what are you waiting for? Try a free demo right now. Visit the Replay Radio website today at replay-radio.com.
Ugh.
Welcome back to the Web Talk Radio Show, and my name is Rob Greenlee, and I've got Dana Greenlee in here with me also.
Glad you could join us. Well, on the line with us rounding out this little trifecta is Frank Catalano. He's a tech analyst for TV and radio, places like NPR and CNET, and now Web Talk Guys Radio.
Yeah, and he's also a tech consultant at Catalano Consulting at catalanoconsulting.com, and he's a blogger at bitemeonline.com. Frank, it's great to have you back on the program with us.
My pleasure.
You just published an article in the Seattle Weekly talking about how spam is killing email as it's becoming a less useful application to share documents and send messages to people. But your thinking is that the damage is being done in some other ways. And the title of your article is Collateral Damage. And your comment is that email just isn't very reliable right now. Well, what are you seeing out there that's giving you that impression is really the root problem here?
Well, the collateral damage is because of the crossfire between spammers and anti-spammers. And pretty much all of us who use email are caught in this crossfire. There are three things that are contributing, basically, to email's decline in reliability. And they are basically crushing volume, undisclosed filtering, and then inconsistent feedback. And if you'd like, I can cover those each briefly.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Talk about the crushing volume, because I think I can relate to that the most.
Well, bottom line is that there's an awful lot of email out there. And it's not just the stuff that we send to each other, and it's not just the viruses like the most recent one, Novark MyDoom, which essentially is overloading many mail servers. It's the whole combination of spam and viruses and legitimate email that provide these crushing volumes to mail servers that just flat out aren't equipped to handle with it, and so they start rejecting mail. If you think spam, by the way, is just about, say, 50%, 60% of all email volume, you're probably mistaken, because that is legitimate spam. It's destined for a real email address. It may still be spam, but it's designed to go to somebody who actually has an email address. There's an anti-spam company called Solid Oak Software, and I've spoken with their CEO, and he says that if you count basically all the stuff like alphabet attacks, where essentially spam is being addressed to every possible letter combination at a domain, stuff that's basically bound for over-quota mailboxes as well, stuff that just can't be delivered. So basically all the undeliverable spam that's out there, then the amount of spam that actually is the total amount of email traffic is above 90%.
Yeah, well, I definitely believe that. One of the other issues about this and people's trust of the medium, and I think that's really at the heart of what you're really talking about here.
I think it is, and I think part of that is you're not sure if a message you're going to get is a message that basically isn't misleading or is spam or is fraudulent, and so you're less likely to open an email message. It's like when we were all kids, we would be thrilled when postal mail arrived for us. We'd be thrilled. We'd open it. We'd get these letters. We didn't care what they were. We were just happy to get something. That's how email was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, we're sort of in the phases where you're an adult, and you get your postal mail, and it's got maybe a letter or two you really want to read, but most of it's bills and junk mail and catalogs and stuff like that. That's pretty much how our email boxes look today. For every 10 decent messages, you've got 90 that are spam or come-ons or something else. And I think that is the real issue with trust that you're getting at. Mm-hmm. You know, the other piece of this crushing volume portion of spam and email's reliability has to do with the fact that many computer users out there don't realize that their own computers have been hijacked by spammers because of some virus or worm that they became infected with a long time ago.
Yeah.
And these are things called remote access Trojans, where essentially if you were infected by something like the So Big worm, which was last year's big worm, and you didn't do anything about it, a spam engine may have been set up on your computer to relay spam messages through your own broadband connection at home without your knowledge. It just slows down your system a bit. And it's pumping out a whole bunch of that spam. So the volume is both a combination of spam that comes from one source and spam that comes from people's own PCs that they're not even aware of the fact that they're helping send.
Sometimes the solutions to some of the spam problems out there are sometimes worse than the problem itself. You start looking at spam filtering at the ISP level.
Yeah, spam filtering is a great concept, but of course, it much like a cold remedy, it treats the symptoms and not the cause. The problem with a lot of spam filtering, it's not the filtering you know about, that you basically have on your computer, like an Outlook 2003, the junk email folder. Stuff like that is pretty straightforward. It's the filtering you don't know about. Mm-hmm. And that happens, for example, when a spammer uses, say, one ISP's mail server to blast out in a brief amount of time thousands of spam messages to a second ISP. that second ISP will say, hey, what's all this? And will immediately put up a block, basically an IP block for mail server to mail server, to reject all incoming email from that first ISP's mail server. Now, if you're not the spammer and you just happen to send email through that first ISP and you try to send it to a friend of yours at that second ISP,
you're out of luck.
You're out of luck. Your mail won't go through. And that block can last 30 minutes. It can last 6 hours. It can last 12 hours. Or depending on how spam compromised your ISP is, it could last forever. I recall that Comcast and AOL subscribers, Comcast people couldn't send anybody an AOL email for 4 days last June because there was this kind of server-to-server block setup. And many major ISPs, Earthlink, Interland, Comcast, AOL, are constantly have this shifting game of puzzles and server-to-server blocks, which are almost never disclosed to the users because they come on and off so fast, but they do mess with your email's reliability.
Now, Frank, I want you to do the best public service announcement you can right here. In your article, you talk about the irony of the company SpamArrest, their challenge response company, but what they do that's really sneaky and strange.
Well, yeah, it's one of these things that I don't think they're doing it yet, but it certainly is one of the oddest privacy policies I've ever seen for an anti-spam company. SpamArrest is based in Seattle. They're pretty well known for as being one of these challenge response services, where essentially you subscribe to them, and then somebody tries to send you an email. Well, that person's email is intercepted by the challenge response provider, and they say, hey, prove you really are who you are, click on this link, and then your email goes through. SpamArrest has, in its privacy policy, they have the right to contact anybody who actually sends their subscribers email for, quote, internal and marketing promotional purposes.
Now, why would they do that?
I think they're basically reserving the right to advertise their own services to people who use that service to contact their subscribers.
I
think it actually runs counter to the whole concept of trying to block spam.
It does.
I have not been on the receiving end of this anti-spam spam, but it does make one take pause, all the convoluted irony of it.
Well, now, Bill Gates made some bold statements down at CES here about how Microsoft is going to defeat spam, by the year 2006?
Yeah, 2006. I applaud Mr. Gates for being an optimist. And it may be that in 2 years we've identified mechanisms by which we can stop most spam. I don't think it'll be implemented by then, because a lot of the stuff that he tends to highlight, which is essentially filtering, it is charging people to send you email on a varying scale based on how much you want to hear from them.
Yeah.
These don't stop spam. The real key was sort of the holy grail of anti-spam is sender authentication. Your email doesn't leave unless the next server down the line is certain you are who you say you are and it's coming from a legitimate email address. That would be the biggest thing to basically stop spam. But because the Internet is not controlled by anybody, including Microsoft, it's really hard once you have an innovation in the Internet to get everybody to agree to adopt it.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm saying that maybe sender authentication, real, true, rock-solid sender authentication, will be in place conceptually and technically by 2006. I do think there's one other final thought I would like to make about this whole thing about why email's reliability is really at stake in the spam anti-spam wars, and it's a lack of feedback. We never know when we send an email that it gets there. Sometimes mail servers are configured not to send back a bounce message if something doesn't get there, because a bounce message can tell a spammer that it's a bad email address.
Yeah.
There has to be a better way for people to know that when you send something, it either gets there or it doesn't, or it's delayed, and it has to be consistent. If you can't trust what you send gets there, what's the point? Just pick up the phone.
Yeah, well, that's true. Frank, thanks for joining us again on the show.
My pleasure.
And we definitely look forward to your next article that provokes our thoughts about what's happening on the web and the Internet, and we definitely look forward to having you back on again.
I look forward to it.
Thanks.
We've been talking with Frank Catalano. He's a tech consultant for Catalano Consulting. You can find him at catalanoconsulting.com or his weblog at bitemeonline.com. That's B-Y-T-E, meonline.com. And read his article at seattleweekly.com. It's in the current issue that hit the newsstands January 28.
Stay with us, because up next we're going to be speaking with Mitch Radcliffe, and he's going to talk to us all about the phenomenon of the social networking sites online. This is Web Talk Radio.
Hey, radio lovers, you can now record thousands of radio stations, listen anywhere you want, and even fast forward over the fluff. How? With Replay Radio. It's easy to use and incredibly cool. Replay Radio turns your PC into a VCR for the radio. To listen, just use your PC, MP3 player, iPod, or car CD player. So what are you waiting for? Try a free demo right now. Visit the Replay Radio website today at replay-radio.com.
Welcome back to Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com, and thank you for listening. And I'm Rob Greenlee, and Dana Greenlee is in here with me.
And joining us is Mitch Radcliffe. He's on the phone. Mitch is the new unnamed official Red Herring blogger at redherring.com, and you can also find more about Mitch at radcliffeblog.com. Mitch is the former co-host of Web Talk Guys Radio for many years, and he comes back on a regular basis to give us his enlightened thoughts on net trends.
Mitch is back with us this week to talk about the social networking sites like Rise, LinkedIn.com, Meetup.com, Friendster, Hipster, and The Tribe. The question we're going to talk about is, are these social networking sites valuable online, and will all them survive or be snapped up by the big online giants? Mitch, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, guys. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you back on the air with us again. You've been up to your normal stuff. You've been blogging all sorts of topics out there here recently, and I just thought I'd pull you in because you seem to be doing a lot with social networking sites out there. I know I'm involved in a few, and I'm seeing your name pop up all over the place, so I thought I'd give you a call and see if you had some thoughts on what was going on with the social networking sites out there and what your opinions were. They seem to be thriving and doing well right now, but I guess the question is whether or not they're going to continue to add value and keep growing. What's your thought, Mitch?
Well, you know, software or internet services always do well when they're not charging anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. It's all free right now, and these sites are like Meetup and LinkedIn and Rise and 6degrees.
They deal with different kinds of services. Some of them are about creating networks online, for instance, business networking, mm-hmm. where I can introduce somebody to somebody else and say, this is a good person, you know, trust them to at least take a call or answer their email.
Yeah.
And some of them are oriented around getting people together in real space, like Meetup, or a lot of the Friendster network is around getting people together to go out and party.
Yeah, exactly. So each one of these networks kind of has a special niche.
Although those niches are filling quickly.
The bigger question is whether or not people are really getting any value out of these things. Are they making business connections? Are they finding friends? I mean, are these things really driving enough value back for people to pay for in the long run? I guess that's kind of the bigger question. And if they're not actually driving that much value for a person to actually pay a subscription fee for them, are they going to wind up being just a part of like Yahoo or Google or some of the other sites, you know, the bigger sites that do these kind of things that can afford to have these kind of services?
Well, I think that some of them may very well turn into real businesses. Mm-hmm. For instance, the company Spoke is a business networking service, and what they're doing is providing a free service to the world so that they can deliver an enterprise solution that companies are paying pretty substantial amounts of money for, mm-hmm. to install and use internally to manage business contacts.
Well, and also, is this because spam is really kind of getting in the way of a lot of communications? One of the things that is kind of driving these networks?
Let's back up to the question about whether or not they're viable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was on the board of directors of Match.com, the dating service, a long time ago. And, you know, for the first couple of years, you have no idea what's going to actually work. You don't know how often people are going to come back. In that case, you know, once people were dating, they didn't need the service anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out they would come back and generally come back 3.5 times before they'd not come back for one reason or another, and we weren't always sure what that was, although the board meetings were interesting because we started reporting success in terms of number of marriages and number of babies produced.
What a criteria, but
yeah.
That's probably an appropriate criteria for that kind of a site.
So I think what you're seeing right now is a lot of experimentation amongst all these companies to see, you know, how much people use this, what the size of a typical network grows to, and then whether or not there's enough interaction between those networks around each person to drive a real business model. There's a new social network site that just came up last week,
uh-huh.
called Orkut.
Orkut, I hadn't heard of that one.
It's Orkut,
mm-hmm.
and it's described as an affiliate of Google.
Ooh, what does that mean?
Well, a lot of people have been talking about what that means, but it seems that means that they've got an engineer that they've either got on payroll or contract,
okay.
named Orkut. That's his first name, which, you know, shows you that parents shouldn't name products.
That's right. It's certainly not that great a name, that's for sure.
But anyway, Orkut and he has a last name that I can't even imagine how you pronounce, Hungarian or something like that.
Okay.
The site is up now and got so much traffic at first that it completely crashed.
Wow.
Over the weekend, on Sunday, the message was up there saying, we've taken this down to fix it. And now it's back up again. And I'm seeing a lot of people rush into this space. Just like every other social network I've seen, there are certain people, and they're the same people who have networks 200 or 300 friends already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then there's the rest of us with 50, 60, 80, or 100.
Yeah.
I don't know whether or not any one of these sites is going to be able to compete without buying and consolidating all the network services from the others. But the problem with a social networking service is you can always go somewhere else and start yet another network.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't expect that there's what you would describe as a proprietary advantage is going to work in this space, because most of the companies that are involved in this are going to have to do something that's open source that allows people to share this information across networks, or no one of them will ever become a viable place for people to stay.
Yeah, and plus, none of these, as far as I'm aware, are actually generating any revenue off of membership or any kind of fees.
Well, that's where the Google connection, I think, gets interesting about ORCID. If you look at the privacy notifications, it suggests that they can use the information about you outside of the ORCID framework, but not outside of their network. And that would mean that they can use it to target your advertising directed at you.
Mm-hmm.
As an ORCID member who might be using Google AdWords or seeing Google AdWords somewhere else on the network.
Mm-hmm.
So not only would you be able to have a search where, not just a search, but say you were on a site that had Google Ads served to it that were related to what the site was about, but because they know it's you, it might be related to what the sites are about. If it was a political site, and since in ORCID they ask what your political orientation is, it might be a conservative site, but because they know you're liberal, they would display ads to liberal publications or books that that criticize conservatives.
Yeah.
So what they're doing is triangulating additional information they can use to target an advertising to their advertisement to you, and that's pretty valuable.
Mm-hmm.
That's a business.
But none of these sites are doing any advertising, as far as I've ever seen.
No, but that doesn't mean that they can't. And like I said, everybody's doing these experiments now to see whether or not and where the business exists. And I'm sure there's business in connecting networks of people. There's this funny little thing called the internet that proves that.
That's what it does well.
Then providing context about those connections is the next big step.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, relatively speaking, the internet appeared in the early 70s, late 60s. We're probably in 1972 as far as social networks go.
Yeah, it's still really early in these days in the progression of these things. But what is the next evolution? What's going to be the next thing we're going to see? I mean, obviously, not all these guys can survive, so there's going to be some level of consolidation coming in the next couple of years or the next year. I mean, is it coming quicker than we think?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going to happen relatively fast. I mean, looking back, we'll say, boy, that was quick.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to take a while. You know, the main backer of LinkedIn and the main backer of Friendster, I think it is, got together and bought one of the key patents in the space.
So now
you've got two guys who have a third interest that they share, yet they're competing.
Okay.
So it's already starting to go on at the very, very genetic level between all these sites, and how the information is shared through protocols like Friend of a Friend, which is a way of displaying, a standardized way of expressing information about the relationships between users on a site or on a service, and OPML, which is a feed that allows you to track what other people are reading. So basically, sort of blogging of blogging.
Yeah.
Or logging of blog. And all of those things, and a bunch of others, too, are beginning to knit all of these services together. And I think you'll see that happening. And I think where the competition is going to break out is what you're starting to see with ORCID, with AOL, thinking about how they would use it, with Yahoo thinking about they're going to use it, is they're all going to try to compete to be the place that is the aggregator of choice. And, of course, you can have multiple aggregators of those kinds of connections describing networks of people. But some of those networks will start to stand out, just as in, say, credit cards. Networks of banks being able to offer the Visa card were more successful than the Bank AmeriCard, which was sort of scattershot across the country when the Visa was introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we're moving into a much more consumer marketing kind of a stage of the development of the internet. And that's where I think you're going to see these social networks begin to play out. And then the question is, can you ever go anywhere and do anything and not have the service provider or the site that you're on know who you are and everything about you?
Yeah,
that's
well,
where it gets worrisome.
That's the security concerns that a lot of these have too. And then, and also whether or not Yahoo will actually launch their own social networking area versus basically acquiring one of these.
Well, they'll do it one way or the other.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, Mitch, it was great having you back on again to talk about the social networking sites. It was great to get your thoughts and opinions on them.
Well, I'm always glad to be here.
I appreciate it.
Or to not be here, but yet be here on the phone.
Well, I appreciate it. And you can be found at radcliffeblog.com and correspondences.org.
Yes, and a new one.
And a new one. You have a new site, huh?
You actually won't see my name on it, but I am working on the Red Herring blog, which is at
www.redherring.com. Okay. Is that live and active right now?
It certainly is.
Wow, terrific.
Went up this last week.
Well, Mitch, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Hang in there, because I know Mitch will. We're not done with that red herring blogger guy, because after the break, we'll be discussing whether AOL and MSN are growing up with its customers, and are they becoming more than just another ISP? You're tuned to Web Talk Radio.
Hey, radio lovers, you can now record thousands of radio stations, listen anywhere you want, and even fast forward over the fluff. How? With Replay Radio. It's easy to use and incredibly cool. Replay Radio turns your PC into a VCR for the radio. To listen, just use your PC, MP3 player, iPod, or car CD player. So what are you waiting for? Try a free demo right now. Visit the Replay Radio website today at replay-radio.com.
You're back with Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com, and thank you for staying with us and listening to the program. I'm Rob Greenlee, and Dana Greenlee is here, too.
And rounding out our little group is Mitch Radcliffe. He hung in there through the break, and Mitch has a new job. He's the unnamed official Red Herring blogger at redherring.com. If you read anything at redherring.com that has the word blog around it, this guy wrote it. And you can find more from Mitch at radcliffeblog.com.
Mitch is back with us to talk about whether AOL and MSN are growing up with its customers and becoming more than just an ISP and possibly becoming a digital TV network over time as content becomes the key part of their business and they become less of an internet access provider and more of a content channel. Mitch, great to have you on the show again.
Hey, glad to be not there and here yet. Anyway.
We're going to have to get you back in the studio soon, though. This phone call stuff.
Yeah, that would involve actual physical contact, and I've decided to eschew that for the rest of my life.
So you're just virtual contact forever.
I'm
here,
virtual,
huh?
Mitch.
Oh, where are you calling in from, Mitch, right now?
I actually have moved into cyberspace.
Oh, so you've
set up a small hut.
What, it's very small, I would imagine. Right?
It is. Well, it's.
I mean, you don't need a lot of room in cyberspace, right?
No, I'm just a few, you know, fleeting
bits. Just a few
bits.
Bytes. Yeah, bits and bytes.
You know, it's funny, actually. I did join one of these three-dimensional, you know, shared space kinds of services, and the whole goal of this service is to make money, you know, where you as a person in this space is supposed to earn money, and there's an economy and all this stuff, which is really cool. But I decided to be homeless. And it freaks people out, because whenever I meet someone, I give them money.
Wow. What a service.
Yeah.
Well, that's
what is
good.
This site? Share. Give us this information.
It's called Second Life. It's you can't just log in. You have to log in, sign up, and download a free trial of a client. But it's actually really sophisticated and cool. You can build three-dimensional things in cyberspace and put scripts on them that will, you know, let wheels turn and have your house talk and all that other stuff.
Okay. That's interesting. So have you moved into like one of the broadband services, computer systems or something like that, like AOL broadband or some of those type of places?
Yes, actually, I've taken over America Online. They're just not aware of it yet.
Okay. You've gotten in through the firewall and okay, penetrated all.
Well, no, not even that. I mean, I actually have taken over the brain of the CEO.
The brain of the CEO. Okay. Well, that's actually pretty cool.
And as such, I am now empowered to make all sorts of crazy stuff happen on AOL.
Well, I think there is a lot of crazy stuff happening at AOL. And one of the things is their AOL broadband service that they have. And one thing that I've always thought for...
Yes, we laugh about that around the office.
Over the years is that AOL's been primarily for, you know, just, you know, beginner users, people that have just gotten involved in the internet and stuff. But as...
I think that's our prejudice, yeah.
Yeah, as broadband has kind of grown and developed, more users have become more advanced and their capabilities online. And I think it was having a little bit of problem with people leaving their service and going over to like an Earthlink or some other service that's maybe a little more advanced. Do you think that AOL is going to be able to make that transition and pull those subscribers back in, you know, especially as they get a little more advanced in their user capabilities?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that they need to pull the subscribers back in. What they need to do is make each subscriber more profitable.
Well, yeah, as far as that goes, but they're losing a lot of subscribers now because
That may be a natural phase for anybody who's been providing connectivity and shifting to delivering content. But, you know, if you look at the size of a major television network at any given hour of the day might have 8 to 16 million people watching it. And if you're talking about a cable channel, they might have a few hundred thousand people watching it.
Mm-hmm.
So if systems like AOL and MSN and Earthlink and Yahoo maybe, who does have a broadband service that they're offering through SBC and a few others, want to compete, they may be thinking more in terms of the economics of a television network. But then the question is, how many people does it take to support a television network where, you know, they're paying maybe $5 a month for it? And the answer is really not that many.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, HBO is a very profitable business. They're receiving probably $1 a month or less per subscriber.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've got probably 35 million subscribers in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So that's $35 million bucks a month. You can do a lot with that.
Yeah, you certainly can. It seems like that the AOL broadband and the MSN service could be moving towards a similar model to what like an HBO is doing. If you look in the over the next 10 or 15 years or something like that, it may come quicker than that, where they're actually considered to be, you know, almost like television networks almost.
Yeah, and I think
it seems that's the direction that they're going.
I think that's pretty clearly where we're going. And so if in the process AOL moves from, say, I think at the high water mark, that including the international markets, they had about 34.5 million subscribers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all paying $21.95 a month. But then, you know, roughly half of that went right out the door to the people who were the companies that were providing the actual connectivity, because AOL didn't do that.
Oh, yeah.
So if you move from having 35.5 million people who are paying $21.95 a month and you're only taking, say, $9.50 home at the end of the day to 15 million people where you're getting paid for content that you're delivering to them and they have their own connectivity but they're paying you 15 or 25 bucks a month, might tier the service where you get movies and other things for an additional 5 or 10 bucks a month. You have a completely viable model and one that wasn't hurt by, you know, the shift to this new delivery mode.
What you're saying, though, is that it's possible for these online services to get the same kind of revenue stream as like an HBO. Over time, there'll be more of a parity.
More like an NBC or an ABC, you know, or a massively consolidated media company, which is, of course, what AOL is, or now is part of. I mean, AOL is owned by the same company that owns HBO.
Yeah. That is true.
HBO is a standalone business within a conglomerate, and AOL will likely be a standalone business within a conglomerate in the same sense.
Yeah, it seems crazy that Time Warner would let AOL go and, you know, sell it or something like that. It seems like that the opportunity that they have is so great if you look out in the future. That
I don't get any sense from people that I know there that they're thinking about selling it.
Selling
I think what they're trying to figure out is how they can use it to
move it forward, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like that's the challenge, and then Yahoo is actually sitting in a pretty good position, I think, moving forward in that regard, aren't they?
And it seems that hiring Terry Semel, who had been a Hollywood executive prior to that, turned out to be a pretty good idea.
Mm-hmm. Because they seem to be able to monetize content and web services even better than AOL has.
Mm-hmm.
So moving forward, those guys, are sitting in a great position. The bigger question is, where does Google fit into all this? I mean, are they going to try and compete directly with this? Do you think over time?
No, I think Google will always be about search and aggregating audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that they'll be providing an arsenal for sites that have an interest in aggregating smaller audiences. So they'll aggregate those micro audiences into rational economic models for advertisers to access and use as marketing platforms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because certainly Google has as big a name as AOL has as far as online goes. And I'm sure they could spin it off in all sorts of different directions. It just depends on what they choose to do, I would think.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much how it's going to go. But then again, you know, I've been more wrong than most people.
That's true.
Oh, that is? Thank you very much.
No, it's not.
Come back here. I'm going to. Oh, okay.
Okay.
I'm going to drop it. I'm not going to get it. Okay. I'm not going to get all huffy about it.
Well, Mitch, thanks for joining us again on the show.
Thanks, great speaking
with you.
Yeah, and like I'll ever come back after that.
That was just a slip of the tongue. You know?
It was, but now we know what your true intent and feeling about me is. Don't you come by my little hovel in cyberspace.
Mitch, tell us really quickly in about 15 seconds where we can read more about you.
Well, you can see it at ratcliffeblog.com. You can also check out correspondences.org, which is the civic journalism site that I helped start. And anybody who wants to be a reporter and contribute to correspondences should go sign up there.
That's great.
And, of course, more of your writings on the economy and business and cyberspace is at?
At redherring.com. You should read their blog.
Terrific. Well, thanks, Mitch.
All right. Thanks.
That's the end of the show this week, and thank you for listening to Web Talk. We do appreciate you taking the time out of your day to tune in and listen to us, and we're going to have a new show for you next week, so you want to check back with us at wherever you listen to us, online or on the radio. We'll see you around the net.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.